Welcome to the Left the Boom Show, your go-to space for transforming businesses into extraordinary, thriving workplaces. Hosts Phil Wilson and Michael Vandervoort share learnings and tips to empower leaders and HR professionals with insights, advice, and stories from top leadership, labor relations, and labor law experts. Hello, this is Michael Vandervoort, and I'm here with my co-host, Phil Wilson, on today's edition of the Left the Boom Show. Hello, Phil. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. Now that we got our little glitches worked out to get started. So want to introduce our guest. Our guest today is going to be a gentleman named Nick Kalm. Known Nick for a number of years. Nick works in the communication business. For the past 30 years, Nick's worked with hundreds of leading corporations, nonprofits, and academic organizations and their leadership teams to enhance, protect, and restore their reputations. I'm not going to go into all the credentials Nick brings. They're great. I'd rather just say hello to Nick and start talking to him about the topic of the day, which is how we can effectively use corporate communications and reputation management to build a great culture. So, Nick, welcome to Left the Boom Show. It's great to have you here. How are you?
Thank you, gentlemen. Great to be here. It's a real pleasure. I'm excited about your new show and to be a guest on it.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you. We love having our friends here because they give us a little break as we iron out the wrinkles, I guess. So Nick, we have a kind of a standard opening question that Phil introduced here, and it's prompted some great conversation. So I'm going to hit you with that to start. And that is, who is someone that believed in you as an individual and as a professional early on, and how did they inspire you to become who you are today?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I'm glad you asked it as well. I mean, a couple of answers that I'd give, they're probably a little bit trite to begin, but not all of them will be that way. I mean, my parents certainly believed in me. You know, they were always been great cheerleaders to me, even though, you know, they came from a very different world. You know, I'm the business person and the communications person. My father was an artist and college professor and administrator, and my mother worked for the UN. So what I'm doing is about as far from what they did as can be, but they always supported me in what I was trying to do. And then when I was trying to go, you know, thinking about going off and starting my own firm, which I did 21 years ago, you know, I couldn't have done it without my wife's support. And she knew I had that entrepreneurial bug in me, and she was wonderfully supportive. So my parents and my wife would be two of them for sure. But then I had some advisors and other friends and colleagues who just kind of encouraged me to do this. And it really helped me get that lift to feel like I could go off on my own and start my own firm. And I've been blessed that I've been able to do that now for the last 20 some odd years.
That's great. The entrepreneurial thing is something I could never see my way through. Phil and you both have let the bug bite you and succumbed. So I don't have much experience, but it's a lot of people's dreams, but it doesn't, you guys have both had great success. So that's really cool.
Well, yeah. And it sounds terribly hokey to say, but it really is true. I mean, 2 weeks into doing this 20 years ago, 21 years ago, I found the thing that I knew I wanted to do for the rest of my career. And what a gift that is. I mean, and then frankly, to be able to do it too, which has been just incredible. So I'm really happy about that.
I do an anniversary lunch with everybody on the team on their anniversary. We're still small enough that I can do that.
Nice.
So Christina's was today, and this was her fourth anniversary. But she reminded me that this is my 26th anniversary.
Wow.
At LRI. And unlike you, Nick, you took that step, and I really do like to talk about like these inspirational leaders in our lives, because you know that like that's really at the core what this whole show's about. I didn't like start, right? My dad had started this years and years before I ever got involved, and so he was really kind of like the one that kind of put it all on the line. Just tell me a little bit about sort of like the encouragement that you got to like take that leap. Cause that's a big leap.
Yeah. I mean, and again, look, as you guys know, I'm based in Chicago, but I didn't grow up here. So I'd been working here for about 6 years when I decided to start my firm. The thing was, at that point, I knew I had enough of a track record working in-house in communications for a bunch of big companies and working for two of the biggest PR firms. I knew that if I failed, I could go back in either in a communications role in a company or in another big PR firm. So I thought, I was at the point in my career, let me try it. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, I can get a job. I was at that point eminently employable because of where I was in my career. I had at that point, whatever it was, almost a 20-year track record. So I knew I could do it. So I figured, you know, what the heck? And again, having a supportive wife and thankfully a home equity line of credit that I could live on. The first year, I was a pretty senior person at the biggest PR firm in the world. And I basically took about a 70% pay cut in the first year to start the firm. But I was so happy to be my own boss that frankly, even if I had stayed making not even what I was making when I was working at the big PR firm, I knew I was going to be happier because I was steering the ship. You know, I could celebrate the team, but I'm not going to be sitting there subjected to other people above me in the food chain making decisions that I didn't necessarily agree with. And that was it. And then just because we were very fortunate to have three great clients literally in the first month. I mean, our first three clients were FedEx, GE, and IBM. Those were clients 1, 2, and 3. You know, I mean, I am not the smartest guy on the block, but if you get those three clients right away and you manage to screw it up, you're doing something wrong.
You know? It says a lot for you, though, that you were able to like pick those up right off the bat. That's the reason I keep my law license up to date is like just in case this whole labor relations gig, you know, doesn't pan out. It's been 26 years, but yeah, you never know.
Exactly.
Phil Wilson and nobody on the shingle. So yeah. Anyway, so Nick, you've talked about making the move. So Reputation Partners, tell us what's important to know about you and your company in terms of what you do for your clients and to help businesses.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, so we're a full service, high touch communications firm that's made up of a lot of smart, really good people. And we've worked with every kind of organization and virtually every kind of situation that can impact any kind of institution. You rattled off the list at the beginning, Michael, you know, corporations, health systems, trade associations, universities, not-for-profits, you name it. If it's anything that they want to try to improve, the reason we call the firm Reputation Partners is if anything they want to improve about their reputation that isn't as widely known, anything they want to protect because it might be under threat for some reason, or if they've gone through a difficult patch and they're trying to get their reputation back, that's what we do. And that's what, you know, we're known for doing, which has been really great. And as for me, as I said, I'm originally from New York, but I'm out here and I'm fully a Midwesterner now, or almost fully. You know, it takes a little while to get that New York out of you. And it's been out. I've been gone now. This month, actually, right now, marks 30 years that I've been in Chicago. So I've been out for a long time. I'm a family guy. I love having a business. I have a son that I'm very proud of and a wife who sticks with me. So that's kind of who I am.
This is not on the sheet, but how big of a difference is there really between like New York and Chicago, right? Because they're kind of like, you know, one and two in terms of culture and pride, when you talk about big cities in America, right?
Again, I've been gone now for a long time, 30 years, but it was, when I moved out here, very different. It took me a full year, I would say, to really kind of dial it down. Because, and you guys know me, I'm still a pretty intense guy, but if you'd seen me 30 years ago, you would have run screaming the other direction. Believe it. I know this is going to be hard to believe. And for anybody who watches this, who knows me, that I've mellowed, but I really have. The intensity and the stress. And again, New York is great. I love going back there. Great restaurants. We have friends and others who are there. It's a wonderful place to visit, but it is a hard place to live. And frankly, I mean, just moving to Chicago, I moved it basically, and I was making the same salary that I was in the New York area, and my standard of living went up 40%.
Yeah.
So, I think that's it. And Chicago is just, I'd say, a smaller, not quite as intense, not quite as stressful place to be as New York. So that's my assessment.
Yeah.
The Midwest is.
You can't totally tell on the screen, but Nick is also, at least from my 5'10 perspective, Nick is like 6'6 or higher. So he's intimidating to because you have to look up in the air to talk to him, right?
I know, so, that's right. That, so far, nobody can see my bald spot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sorry, Phil, I talked over you.
But he blocks a lot of wind. Like, you want to get behind. Yeah, if you're in Chicago, you want to definitely be walking behind Nick.
And I create my own wind, too.
Yeah, that's true. Before we segue, you know, you talked a little bit, you know, Nick, about your team and about like the work that you do, but you know, we've worked together on a number of projects, and I just would add, like, they are a, you know, you talk about high touch, like just a great team to work with, and very, you know, very smart and capable folks there. So they're
really Phil. Yeah. Cause I mean, and again, it's been great to work with your folks too. It's like, I mean, the thing is, look, we knew we were going to be competing with like the big firms that I used to work at, and we do all the time. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, what we're able to provide that they're just not set up to do is that high touch client satisfaction. We're obsessed about that stuff. Yeah. I mean, we have a 99%+ 15-year net promoter score. And that's the thing I'm most proud of, you know? And again, look, we drop the ball every now and again. I'm sure we annoy some clients for sure, and others wouldn't hire us again, but we've worked with like 700, almost 800 clients now. And, you know, having that kind of 99% net promoter score over, you know, over 15 years says we're doing something right. And that's something I really try to instill in the team. And that's the kind of people that I try to surround myself with and obviously deliver whenever we're working with clients.
Yeah, you do a great job.
Thanks.
Yeah. So 800 clients, that I didn't realize that. I knew you were busy, but I didn't realize you guys were that prolific in your client base. That's great.
Hello.
What, so you work with all, as you just said a second ago, all sorts of industries, all sorts of individuals. What do you tell the CEOs or your, you know, whoever your main client is, what are the three things you tell them that they need to do in terms of communications when you start dealing with a client?
Yeah, I mean, for CEOs specifically, and we're very often dealing directly with these folks as we should, because a lot of this really, I mean, what an organization does or doesn't do is going to be driven by whoever's at the top. So I'd say one for CEOs, and again, you've seen a lot of them get away from this for a number of reasons. The interesting thing that a lot of people who don't deal with CEOs all the time are surprised by is a lot of those folks are very introverted. You know, they're very happy just sort of in their office doing their own thing. So the number one thing we tell people is CEOs in particular is you've got to be visible, both internally and externally. Mm. Don't just sit there in your ivory tower or your home office or whatever it is and just deal with your direct reports and not the rest of the organization. You've got to be out there. Let them see you. Let them hear from you. That's number one. That's both with employees, customers, all kinds of outside stakeholders and so forth. Number two, I'm going to use, I think Merriam-Webster came up with the word for 2024, authentic. Mm. Be authentic. There's so much that happens where organizations, oh, we don't want to tell our employees that, or we'll freak them out, or we don't want to say this to the community, or they'll be upset, or we don't want to say this to our customers. People are adults. And one of the things that's true about where we are now in, you know, 2023, 2024 is, you know, people want the truth. People can handle the truth as opposed to Jack Nicholson and A Few Good Men. We can handle the truth. They mm-hmm. want treat people like adults, be authentic about if things are going well, talk about things going well. If things are challenged, be honest about it. It's not like people aren't going to know, and you're just going to get so much more credibility with them if you are authentic. And then the third one is to be responsive. Be responsive to society, be responsive to employees, be responsive to the market, be responsive to your customers, be responsive to other stakeholders.
And I would say, like, the on that authentic piece in the middle there, one of the things that so Chris Matthews, that had the show Hardball, before that he had the book Hardball, and was, you know, prior to that you know, he was Jimmy Carter's speechwriter. And so one of the big lessons in that book that I probably the main one I took away from it, I still talk about it even to this day, is hang a flag on your problem. And the, you know, around that whole authenticity piece, you know, you can pretend like you can hide the ball for, you know, some period of time, but like the truth will come out eventually. In this world, it's likely to happen sooner than later. Absolutely. And like, you want to be the person who tells people like what's going on, and hey, there's a problem, and I want to make sure that you hear about it from me, and I wanted you to hear it from me first. Like, pretending you can punt and avoid like the whatever aftermath is going to happen, like it's going to happen at some point. And the longer you wait, and especially if you're responding to it versus like you own it, it's a whole different environment, right?
Totally. Absolutely. And look, the example we stumble up using, even though it's from years and years ago, think about the Gulf oil spill and Tony Hayward at BP. If he had just come out at the very beginning and said, look, guys, this could be really bad. This could be, I mean, I don't want to scare anybody, but this could mean that the Gulf of Mexico could not be used for fishing or boating or swimming for years to come. We could end up with tens of millions of gallons of oil in the Gulf. I'm telling you that that's the worst case scenario. We're going to work our tails off to make sure that doesn't happen, but I want to prepare you. You set it up so that it could be worse, and then whatever it is, if it's not as bad, people go, oh, good.
Right.
That wasn't so bad. Versus,
what a good job you did to like, yeah.
Versus, it's this big, it's a little bigger, it's bigger, it's bigger, it's bigger, yeah. It's bigger. People go, you don't have a handle on it. You don't know what you're doing. What is going on? Same thing with data breaches. Same thing with all of these other things. Everybody wants to try to contain it, which is inauthentic, even if they don't know. You don't want to scare people. But if you create the expectation that things could be bad, but we're doing everything we can to address it, and then it ends up being anything less bad, you look like a winner.
Yeah. Yeah.
The we talked about this on the phone briefly the other day. We didn't really talk about it, but I mentioned it, and that is the Chicago Blackhawks thing that just happened with Connor Bedard, their new they were caught up in what is sounds like a workplace HR investigational issue with a player who misbehaved. And of course, sports always throws everything into weirdness, right? Everything's magnified because everybody wants to know. But the bottom line of the way they handled this one, unlike the last one from a decade ago with their child abuser physician or whatever it was, I can't remember, they still didn't come out and tell anybody what was going on, and they let their star draft number one draftee get dragged through the muck on social media for 3 days, and it was just horrible.
Well, yeah, I mean, because
I don't want to ask you to bash the Blackhawks, but like that transparency, like how do you deal with that? How do you deal with like the need to investigate and make sure you're fully informed before you start sharing information?
Well, I mean, because this is one of those situations where, again, you've got lawyers saying one thing, you've got management wanting to do another, you've got communications advisors wanting to do a third thing. And again, it has to be, it's important for anybody who's in a leadership position to sit there and surround yourself with a lot of smart people, get their best advice, and then you're paid the big bucks as the CEO to make a decision. Don't overly defer to the lawyers, don't overly defer to the communications people. But in a case like that, Michael, where you're talking about the Blackhawks and they've been in negative headlines before in terms of their personnel management issues or mistakes that they've been making, they need to be a lot more transparent about stuff. Now, but we all know, and your viewers know, because they live in and around the world of HR, you can't sit there and talk publicly about HR matters, because that, first of all, it creates all kinds of new litigation risk for the organization. And plus, it leaves everybody in the organization thinking, wait a minute, something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. Is my boss going to hang my personnel file out to dry? So it's a tricky business, but you've got to think through it. If you've been through a situation like this once, as the Blackhawks were several years ago, and it happens again, then suddenly people start realizing, look, any organization can have a fluke. Any organization can have something like this happen to them once. But when something happens to an organization that's similar enough in nature that it happened several times, it's like that organization has a problem with its HR policies.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. why does reputation matter is the next question. What would you tell a company that they should do? So let me start that over. Why does reputation matter so much? And what do you tell your clients when they want to improve their reputation? What kind of steps do you encourage them to take?
Yeah, because so much is tied to it, right? Shareholder value, employee recruitment, retention, customer satisfaction, deal flow, right? If you're a company that wants to acquire other companies or do joint ventures or go into new markets or whatever, if you've got a bad reputation, people aren't going to take your calls or letters. They're not going to want to do business with you. Mm-hmm. And if you're in the midst of a deal discussion and something bad happens and you can't provide the right context of it, that deal is going to disappear and go away. Community support, litigation, regulations, right? if you seem like a good company, a good, well-run company, there's all kinds of studies that show that that companies that are the Fortune most admired have higher shareholder returns than companies that are least admired. You've seen even, you know, we've talked a lot in our various circles about what's happened, not to pick on any company, but look what happened with Starbucks. Mm-hmm. I mean, Starbucks mm-hmm. was a company that was at the very top of their category in the most admired, and they are falling precipitously as a result of what's been going on with them and all of the union organizing that they've been facing and how they've responded to that. And all of that impacts reputation. And then Howard Schultz giving his talk. Again, all of this, many different things that go into it, but it just impacts so many different metrics. You know, if you're trying to recruit the best and the brightest to run your new division, right? Your reputation, your organization's reputation, your leader's reputation impact that so much. And it's all goes into, you know, what the accountants talk about as goodwill. It's not the book value of an organization, but it's all of the other things that go into why is that organization worth what it is. And it impacts all of those different things.
I mean, it can be the book value too, right? It's absolutely, you know, like look at Twitter or whatever it's called today. I mean, there are tens, hundreds of millions of dollar of like value that are just getting flushed down the toilet all around reputation.
Exactly. Amazing. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, God bless him, but Elon Musk, I mean, it's great to sit there at $44 billion on something and then have that $44 billion only be worth whatever, $17 billion was the most recent figure. I mean, losing $27 billion. I mean, I'd be pretty bummed if I lost $27 billion.
Yeah, I mean, he can afford it, but I mean,
I think you would be too. You
know? Yeah, that's, I mean, that is just, it is hard to wrap your mind around the amount of value that has, and, you know, look, companies go up and down in value, but that is a microcosm of that is just purely reputational. I mean, that is just purely reputational. And the fact that billions of dollars can be tied to that is pretty like incredible.
It's crazy. Well, and look, I know one of the things we want to talk about is, you know, when companies sit there and wade into issues, right? And this mm-hmm. is the company I keep talking about, and we've seen it is Disney. I mean, look at now, Disney finally now, I'm stunned by this, they're finally acknowledging in their public financial disclosures that their controversial takes on issues are costing them market share, reputation, and valuation. I mean, so, you know, they're doing it. They've done it knowingly. They then ended up in that whole battle with Governor DeSantis. They've done all of the other things that folks who are critical of companies that seem to be going woke, so to speak. I mean, it is dramatically hurting their business, the people that they're putting in charge of the films that they're deciding to make. I mean, that's why they're getting, Nelson Peltz making a run at a proxy fight there, because their feeling is that the company is not being well managed, even though they lured Bob Iger out of retirement to rerun the company. So you've got, there is, again, I've seen companies doing this, and I've, as you guys know, I've opined frequently. I'm like, we are such a divided country. Everything is controversial. Why in the world would you take positions that you automatically know are going to antagonize and potentially enrage half the country? Now, that's the thing. One of the things we talk about is why do companies do this, right? They do this because they have a vocal minority of their employees. That's why they took the position they did on the so-called Don't Say Gay law in Florida, Disney, I'm talking about.
Yeah.
A vocal minority of their employees pressured them to do it. And again, I get it. Look, I said earlier, what's something that CEOs need to do? They need to be responsive to society. So I'm not saying sit there and put your head in the sand, but think about how does this align with our values? How are our customers going to view this? How are our shareholders going to view this? How are our partners going to view this? Don't just get the loudest group sitting there chewing on your ankle saying, you must take a position on this terrible legislation, and then go, okay, well, I guess we're going to go do that. You got to think through the implications, because these have multi-billion-dollar implications for companies.
Yeah, and there's a difference between an issue that is like at the core of your business. I've seen you write and talk about this. Yeah, there are some issues that like you have to take a stand on because it's like it's a core part of who you are as a company. And then there's these extraneous that are like, it's not that they're not important, like they're wildly important, you know, and there's diametrically opposed views on them, and but it's like, if it's not really core to your offering and core to your, even if it upsets like a bunch of people in your organization, if it's not really core to who you are and to like what you're bringing to the world, there's really not a reason for a company to like jump into the middle of that. And it's sort of become fashionable to do that, but it's, it seems to me, I mean, it's not just the reputational risk, but it's also like, are you really, it creates all kinds of distraction. It creates all, it, you know, it veers you off of like what you should be concentrating on all the time. Absolutely. There's all kinds of costs to it.
Well, and the other example I love pointing to is Delta Airlines, with their huge hub in Atlanta. You know, they were looking to get some sort of significant tax breaks from the state of Georgia. And then they came out after the state of Georgia passed some sort of Voting Rights Act, Voting Enforcement Act, Voting Integrity Act, and criticized that. Again, what does voting integrity have to do with an airline and their business, to your point, Phil? Zero. And what happened then was the legislature said, guess what? That nice tax break that you wanted, and airlines operate generally on a pretty lean profit, that tax break is gone. Have a nice. And again, all that because they decided to wade into, again, to your point, Phil, a legitimate societal issue. But what in the world does it have to do with an airline, right?
Right.
So that's the challenge. It's like, and again, I want to be clear. I'm not saying that companies should completely stay out of every issue, but go through, you know, if a company was deciding at some point that they wanted to go back in, I'm making this up, they wanted to go back into Russia. Everybody pulled out of, not everybody, but the vast majority of companies pulled out of Russia after they invaded Ukraine. If you're deciding as a company, you make widgets, you're a multi-billion-dollar widget company, and you pulled out of Russia because they invaded Ukraine, then you start thinking about going back in if for whatever reason they end up with a ceasefire or a peace treaty or whatever, a withdrawal, or the war is over. You don't just sit there and go, okay, now we're just going to go back in. No, you go, well, let's see, what's the risk? Well, how has currency changed since then? What's the likelihood that Russia is going to decide to invade one of its neighbors? I mean, you go through a calculus there. Why would you do that on that kind of a business decision with such bottom line implications, but not go through a similar exercise when it comes to taking a position on a controversial issue?
Yeah. I totally agree.
This is a tangential question, Nick, but I think it's really relevant to this, what we've just talked about. And that is like, whether you think of politics, the division in politics, or the division in religion, and like in the U.S., you know, are you faith-based or not, or, you know, or Hamas versus Israeli? Surely that stuff must come up in your practice. How do you help companies deal with that? Because that is like, if you're not in agreement, it seems like then you're canceled, no matter which side you're on, right? So, and sometimes you can't stay out of it. Like you get dragged into it, whether you want to or not.
Absolutely, and no matter what, we tell clients, you have to be prepared. You're going to get slings and arrows because nothing you do, and if you choose to do nothing,
right,
is going to annoy someone. So you just have to understand that the idea of pleasing everybody. So the same way we tell you, don't deliberately antagonize half the country on the one hand. On the other hand, don't assume you're going to be able to please everybody by doing something anyway. I mean, this is a perfect example of that is the whole Bud Light, Dylan Mulvaney controversy, right? They waded into that, thinking they were just doing this promotion with this one influencer. And again, historically, boycotts have not worked. Boycotts have just been some noise and people sign petitions and it maybe has a tiny little impact on sales. In this case, it was completely different than that. So it's just a matter of really making sure that you are understanding what you're stepping into and why, and that's it. And if you're not prepared to realize that you can say, look, I appreciate that this issue, whatever it might be the George Floyd murder, whatever it is, something along those lines. And I understand that the George Floyd murder impacted and inflamed public sentiment like nothing has happened in years since then, right? I get that. And I understand that some of our employees are pressuring us to support Black Lives Matter, for example. We know that what we need to do as a company is we need to make sure that we're respecting everybody. And we have a lot of different constituents to serve. But yeah, but that means you're supporting racists. No, we don't like racists. We don't support racists. But we're not going to sit there and come down on the side of some position on some issue that is going to antagonize the customers that we really want to serve and the communities that we want to serve. Mm-hmm. So we've got our values. Here's our values. Here's our principles. Here's how we're going to operate our company. Here's how we're going to promote from within. Here's how we're going to compensate people. Here's how we're going to treat the environment. Here's how we're going to create advancement opportunity for people of color. All of those different things, we're going to do the right thing there, but we're not going to allow ourselves to be saying we support X or we oppose Y. That's hard to do. And again, people go, oh, you're just being, you know, namby-pamby. You're gutless. You won't take this. You know what? And you just take that issue. And again, nobody's going to sit there and love you for taking that position, but you're not going to create enemies the way some of these organizations have unwittingly done.
Yeah.
So that brings up kind of like reputational rules. And I guess the next question would be, and you mentioned a couple of, you know, the oil business, say, versus the healthcare business or whatever. Do certain companies or certain types of industries get more of a pass or more scrutiny depending on what they do you think?
Yeah, I think in general, business-to-business companies generally get less scrutiny because they're not customer-facing and they make components for other companies. So they don't really have to enjoy the support of the public. You know, the consumer-facing companies get the most. The highly regulated companies and industries also get a lot. And then just if you think about the industries that just happen to touch the widest number of members of the public, get a heck of a lot. We talked about airlines before, because, right, not everybody flies, but a vast majority of the American population flies. Food is another one, right? We all need that. That's universal. And entertainment is up there as well, because it's nearly as universal. So those industries get a disproportionate amount of the scrutiny because of the lines of business they're in. And then other industries as well, obviously, you know, it's regulated, but healthcare, right? We all need it. We all worry about our health. We all want to make sure that we can, you know, get through the day, week, month, year, and be healthy. And, you know, nobody likes to go to the doctor. Nobody wants to be in the hospital. Nobody wants to have to take pharmaceutical products, but we all need to varying degrees. So that industry broadly, healthcare, gets a lot of scrutiny as well. And then like I said, some business to business and some other companies that are just less consumer facing do. And of course, then there's the very controversial industries like tobacco and guns and alcohol and so forth that traditionally get a lot of attention because, you know, they arguably don't necessarily have a huge societal benefit, and they actually have quite a significant societal cost.
All of those sort of share like reputation and, you know, PR is also a part of the way that they like get business, right? And how they compete for business is, you know, like they advertise a lot more than the widget, you know, maker who's somewhere in the supply chain. And that lever of negative PR and negative publicity is more valuable to pull if you're opposed to that, you know, position or opposed to that company or opposed to what they're doing than it is for someone who's kind of like not, you know, that just doesn't mean as much, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, and look, the tobacco industry in particular, they've had to put tremendous amounts of dollars and resources into trying to build up goodwill because for years and years, you know, before we started exploring these, you know, non-flaming cigarettes and tobacco product, that's all they were known for. And it's like, how do you defend that? I mean, that's basically, you haven't been able to advertise it in almost 60 years, but you're going to defend it. But they would spend lavishly on supporting cultural institutions, educational institutions, because they knew they needed to buy goodwill because the nature of their products were such that they were very controversial. And it made it tough then for a lot of these organizations that were on the receiving end of it, because they knew that they couldn't sit there and come out and say, yes, smoking is okay, but it quieted them down and made them less likely to be critical of the companies that were funding them so lavishly.
Yeah.
We're going to start crunching on time here, so I'm going to keep us moving along. Let's switch gears a little bit, realizing that you have a bit of bias inherently baked into the next question. Do you think companies need more help with internal or external communications, and kind of tell us what the differences are.
What's his bias? He's like, they need both.
Well, yeah, I mean, but you know what? It's interesting. For a lot of companies, they need more help with internal, but it's a big psychological leap that they need to make, that they admit that they have trouble speaking to their own employees. Mm-hmm. A lot of organizations think that they're, all right, we don't talk to the media every day, help us talk to the media, or we don't talk to the community or to, you know, advocacy groups or whatever, universities or whatnot. So they, you know, we don't talk to them every day, help us talk to them. But often a lot of the organization, so if they don't talk to them, they need help there. Internally though, the interesting thing is that what we see with a lot of organizations, and I know you guys see this as well, is they don't necessarily listen. They don't know how to communicate with their employees, which is a difficult thing for them to admit. It's funny, and you guys will laugh at this, and I'm sure your viewers will when they see this as well. It's like, I've lost count of the number of companies that I've talked to. I'm like, so tell me, what are your primary employee communications vehicles? Well, we use email. That's great. Well, how many of your employees are manufacturing or plant-based? Oh, 70, 80%. Well, do they read email? Oh, no, they never look at email. Like, okay. So 70 or 80% of your employees, the only way you communicate with them is with a technology that they don't use. So it's not working. So it's, again, that's something as basic as that, but even just understanding how are they communicating with the employees, right? Are they using newsletters? Are they using video? Are they using chat? What are they doing? And is it working? So many of these things, so interesting. We've seen this with so many companies. They build up these vehicles and they put teams and reporters in front of, let's put out this magazine and let's put out this video series. And we'll come in and we'll say, so folks, is this stuff working? We're like, we think so. What, have you tested it? Have you asked people where they're reading it? You know, one of the best tests you can make is stop publishing something for a little while and see if anyone notices. Mm-hmm. And if no one notices, then it wasn't working. And maybe you didn't need to do it in the first place. So the shorter answer, which I've not given, but the short answer I'll give to your question is it really depends on the organization, but it's harder for them to acknowledge, I think, that they need help talking to their own employees. But that's often one of the most critical audiences you can get, because that's, you've got 5,000, 10,000, 300,000 ambassadors to the company that if you're not talking to them the right way, how are they talking about your business to the people that they're interacting with personally or professionally?
And I'm curious if you know, I think you agree with this, but it's also very common that employers think they do a good job of communicating just because they have, you know, they've got some vehicles or they've got, like, you know, they've got the newsletter and the email. And so they look at all that as like, we're great communicators, and they're terrible, and they don't have any inkling that they're terrible until maybe something comes up where they've invited, you know, you and me, you know, to come help them, because it's like, no, you guys are so asleep at the switch. Not asking the questions that you said. I mean, communication is a two-way event, right? Like, you have to listen and you need to discuss and talk and empathize. And like, there's a lot more to communication than just send out a newsletter or send out a, you know, an email.
100%. Absolutely. Yeah, no, there is that feeling. Even just like, you know, well, do you survey your employees? Yeah, well, you know what? We did it before the pandemic and we haven't done it since. Yeah. Well, when you did it 4 years ago, what did you do with it? Well, we looked at some of the data. Well, did you share anything with your employees? No, we didn't. Like, wait, what? No? Okay. So.
Yeah, I had a situation at one of my former employers where we had a business unit that every year we would do our, you know, our employee voice survey, and it would, their results would get worse, and they'd scurry around and do stuff and try to fix it, and it would get worse. And that happened like 3 or 4 years in a row. And they finally went, we've tried everything. And so I wound up being inserted in and went over and just started doing individual meetings with employees. And I'm asking them, do they communicate with you? Well, no. And, you know, yes, manager, what are you doing? Well, we got a newsletter, we got TV monitors, we got stuff up there. And so I asked the employees, right? Like, well, do you read the newsletters? No, nobody ever picks them up. What about those monitors? They're all over the place. Yeah, but they're not in areas where we can see them. Like, you know, so like they were, to your point, Phil, they were doing stuff, valiantly trying to fix it, but they weren't doing the things that the people, like, it wasn't valuable to the people. So the solution was just expended energy, right? And I think that happens over and over and over again. That must be super frustrating. So Nick, switch gears a little bit. Books and resources that you might recommend to clients. Which ones do you have a set of books or other kind of resources that you recommend to clients the most?
I mean, I really encourage clients to look at case studies, to talk to understand companies and organizations that have been through some of the same kinds of things that they've been through as well. So Harvard Business Review is always great for case studies. You can get some good stuff out of the conference board and other organizations as well like that. Really encourage that kind of thing specifically. Go talk to somebody and learn from somebody who's been through this before. Certainly, consultants like us can help as well, but I know that a lot of clients just really like be able to connect with people who are like peers of theirs, who have gone through or are going through similar experience. I tend to be very sort of practically focused on that stuff, and that's really what I encourage them to do. So find those case studies, talk to the people who've opined about these kind of issues or spoken at conferences or participated in case studies with the HBR or others to really use that as a starting point to figure out what it is that you need to do and learn from for sure. But having that outside perspective, I mean, we all have our faults, but sometimes it takes our spouses or our friends or our colleagues to say, you got a little bit of spinach stuck between your teeth, and we wouldn't have otherwise noticed that ourselves.
Phil loves his books, and he reads all the time. So I don't. What's your take? What do you? How do you approach it with our clients, Phil?
Like for communications, I mean,
the book recommendations and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, I like so a one that just came out recently. We're actually going to do a lunch and learn on this book. I don't know if you've read it, Nick, called Magic Words.
Oh, yeah.
So that's I don't know if that's Chip and Dan Heath or if it's Chip. Yeah, okay. Who like but the so the no, that's not the Heaths. That's who wrote that? You've got it right there.
Jonah Berger.
Yeah, Jonah Berger. Yeah. That book's terrific, and
This is very good. You gave it to me, in fact,
yeah.
so.
Oh, I forgot. Okay, well, no wonder you have it. I think that book's great. Like I said, like I talked about it already, but Hardball is a terrific book, and it's about communicating just in general, not about like the stories are mostly politically related, but the communication principles in it, I think are really, really good. Chip and Dan Heath, that's why I was thinking about they did they had a book called Made to Stick, and one of the key lessons, in that book relates to being able to visualize what it is that you're communicating about. They tell a great story about there were like all of these different, some company had like I forget how many different SKUs of gloves, and so you could tell the story like in words, going like, "Hey, we have way too many SKUs of gloves. Here's a list of them." But what they did was they went to a conference table, they got one of each SKU of glove and put it on a conference table and invited everybody to come in. Didn't tell them anything other than just there's this table piled over with gloves, and they're like, "What the hell is that?" And they're like, "That's all the different gloves that we try to sell." And so different. So how can you? We do this like in campaigns where can you illustrate like the amount of money that you spend each year in union dues, for example. You can say it's going to be X number of dollars, but it's way better to show like shopping carts overflowing with all the stuff you could buy with the money that you would otherwise pay in union dues to go like, is it
Absolutely.
worth it?
Oh, yeah.
So
Picture's worth a thousand words for sure, that too.
yeah.
So last question, and then we'll wrap up. Last question is, would you say that there is, we like to throw our pop culture references in, so is there one Lord of the Rings, one ring to rule them all for a successful communication strategy?
Phil said it earlier, it's listening. I mean, I think that's it. You can come up with the most magic words. We were talking about magic words, and I think that's so key. But unless you're set up to actively listen, and this is, you guys do this obviously with your approachable leadership training so much too. It's like you've got to make sure that people are actually listening to the people that they're speaking to and hearing from them and creating an environment where they feel like they are heard. If you do that, you can even get by with so-so communications to them. But if they're feeling heard and valued and respected, that's number one. And that's a muscle that is not terribly well developed in a lot of companies right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, that's along with frontline leadership who listen. That's like two main things that companies really need to focus resources on. Nick, where can people find you and Reputation Partners? And then if you have any final.
Yeah, no, this is a great discussion. I really enjoyed this very much. As you can tell, I love talking about reputation stuff. So we're, you know, simple, reputationpartners.com. I'm on LinkedIn, Nick Kalm, N-I-C-K-K-A-L-M, like cool, calm, and collected, but with a K. And that's where we are. And we've got, a good website that talks about what we do and try to do some good thought leadership out there. Phil, you're my hero in terms of thought leadership. I'm just trying to swim in your wake here a little bit, but it's good stuff. And I'm delighted to be with you guys. And I'm look forward to continuing to build a relationship with everybody.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Nick. This was, great discussion, great tips. Hopefully people find some good practical takeaway. Like I said before, you know, if you have a communication issue, Nick is my first call like that. So if you do have any kind of internal, external communications issue, be sure and look Nick up. And I like, you're a great follow on LinkedIn too. So you have a lot of, you know, you'll weigh in on a lot of these like events of the day, and, you know, you see a company that's blowing it and you don't step away from that. You're like, here, look, here's an example of somebody that is talking about something that they probably need to just like stay on the sidelines, or they need to, you know, don't just say, hey, we're investigating. Like, you need to explain what's going on. Yeah. That, you know, you're going to lose the story.
Yeah. Just trying to help people. I think it's good to, like I said, case studies are so important, but it's also useful to watch when companies are shooting themselves in the foot. Don't do that.
Yeah. One last thing, I know we got to go, but you're also a good follow. Like, one of the things I love about, I've gotten to know you and your team's culture, you know, a little bit, but you're also a good follow as an example of a company that like really celebrates its team, celebrates the growth and development of that team. It's a great window into what, you know, a small business should be doing to like build a great culture. So I think that's another like really good reason to follow you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, Nick, thanks so much for joining us on Left the Boom today. We're going to go ahead and wrap up. Phil, hope you have a great rest of the day and enjoy your weekend in Chicago, Nick. Hopefully
Thank
the weather's
you.
Not too
chilly. Gentlemen, great to see you both as always. Appreciate it.
See you soon, Nick. Thanks.
Take care.
Yeah. Bye now.